This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Back in the fall of 2002, North Carolina Senator John Edwards went on Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and the senator made an unusual promise.
What do you think about running for president? You know, have you thrown your hat officially into the ring?
Or? No, I'm thinking about it, but I hadn't decided anything. Probably will at the end of the year.
Do you think one of the first people you'll tell is me?
Or no, you don't think you'll... No, I'm certain you'll be the first person I tell.
Is that true?
No question about it.
What would go into...
On this show, as a matter of fact.
Is that true? It'd honestly be the only news that's ever been broken on this show. We've never had news broken.
Now, part of the gag there was that The Daily Show is not a serious political talk show at all, but a show that turns real news headlines, especially politics, into laughs. As Jon Stewart has repeatedly explained, it's fake. Still, Senator John Edwards upheld his end of the deal, and a few months later he announced on The Daily Show that he would indeed be running for president. Some scholars see events like this as part of a trend of late-night TV shows blending comedy with real political news. In an election season, more people seem to be getting their campaign news and political commentary from shows like The Daily Show, The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, The Late Show with David Letterman than ever before. And we're going to talk about that this hour. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. With us is Bernard Timberg. He's a researcher and author based in Charlotte who's been watching this trend for a while. Bernard Timberg has visited the writing rooms and production studios of some of these shows, and he joins us now from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. Hi there, Bernard Timberg.
Hi.
And we're also joined by Stephen Green, professor of political science at NC State. Welcome back, Steve.
Hi, thanks.
Well, why is this happening? It's been a busy election season for the talk shows. John Edwards, not the only candidate to break news on late-night TV. Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, announced he was going to run for governor of California on The Late Show with Jay Leno. And it seems like many, many of the candidates have appeared on the talk shows, on the TV talk shows late at night, the comedy shows, for interviews. So why are we seeing more of this, Bernard Timberg?
Okay, well, I have a theory about it, and I'd love to hear what Steve has to say if he works, you know, with the realities of voters and voting. And I've spent my time, as you put it, in the writers' rooms and in the control room, watching a show go on the air where the real editing happens. And it's a fascinating process. And often the comedy news people, and I actually put it into one word now, comedy, capital N, news, often don't see themselves as being more than having fun. You know, you're not doing brain surgery, as Letterman used to put it. But they're having an effect, and that's where I'd like to hear from Steve. My theory is this, and I'll put it out there and be glad to get responses. I think a turning point was the period before the invasion of Iraq. I know I was, like everyone else, following things, and the country was engaged in a real debate, but you wouldn't know that from the news headlines. You wouldn't know that from the major network presentations. And news credibility had been going down for a long time, I think, since the takeover of the 80s, and when the news, the broadcast news was really more and more for the companies and less the kind of thing that Edward R. Murrow represented. So by the time the war hit, the major news networks became not much more than public relations vehicles for administration, the administration day by day on task promotion of the invasion as patriotic, as necessary. And I'll go farther than that. I think we were into a period of the new McCarthyism where someone did speak out, the Dixie Chicks, Bill Maher, in a famous joke about who really has courage in the bombing of Afghanistan, that drew fire. And the one place I could find critical, intelligent commentary, voices against the war, using humor, but also making very good points, was the Jon Stewart Daily Show, Bill Maher, the guests they had on, Michael Moore, Al Franken, Janine Garofalo. This makes it seem like all the humor was coming from the liberal left anti-war side, and that's not true. A lot of it was, but a lot of the intelligent critique was. For a polar example, there have always been funny people who are conservative.
If you just go to radio, too, it's part of Rush Limbaugh's appeal.
I was going to just mention Rush. He has a kind of raucous humor, and if you agree with him, it's very funny. If you don't, it's not that funny. But the same could be said of Michael Moore. Mm-hmm. If you agree with him, he's dead on, and if you don't, he's not that funny. Humor still is very much in the eye of the beholder and the beholder's politics.
And we also have Dennis Miller, who comes from the right. At least he's very much pro-Bush administration this time around, and he has his program, too. So, but the question
and
comes
Bob
back
Dole
to...
Bob Dole is very funny, and to take the most recent comedian, because the politicians are now in the act, Dick Cheney turns out to have a dry, rapier wit. The curmudgeon is very, very funny when he wants to be.
So, Steve Green, are the politicians getting funnier? Are they just taking advantage of another place to get their message out by appearing on these shows?
The latter.
Yeah.
You know, people are people and politicians are always going to vary on that. But I think they are being rewarded more for being funny because going on Letterman or The Tonight Show or Jon Stewart is really an option that has only existed in the past few presidential elections. And you know, they put an emphasis on it because they know it's a great way to kind of show that, their personable appeal. They're not going to get those tough questions about, well, how come you said this on Iraq, but you've done this? So it's a great opportunity for them. And, you know, I'm pretty sure they all have, you know, professional joke writers on their staffs now because that is a way, an alternative way for them to try and get their message out in a much more candidate-friendly environment.
Well, I would like to follow up with two questions there. First of all, will they be rewarded with votes? Because ultimately that's what matters for politicians, whether that appearance is going to give them votes in November.
I mean, not a lot because, you know, the ratings and the numbers of people who are watching that, though it's growing compared to getting the news from traditional sources, is still much lower. But, you know, insofar as it helps a candidate craft an image of George Bush, for example, as a guy you want to drink a non-alcoholic beer and eat pretzels with sort of thing, you know, I think that does work for candidates and helps them get votes because so much of the appeal candidates try and get now is just based on, you know, I'm a guy that you can sit down and have a beer with and you want to be president. And, you know, certainly Bill Clinton as well is somebody who very much crafted an appeal and just this is a personable type of guy. And that's certainly something that's worked very well for George Bush.
So is it necessarily the case that the questions that these politicians would get when they go on the late night shows are going to be softer? I think that's been accepted as a truth for years that, you know, Johnny Carson years ago was not going to ask really tough questions, probably not Jay Leno or David Letterman. But these other guys,
well,
I've got to wonder.
I'll step in. Bill Maher will.
Yes. Right.
Bill Maher will do, as asked, using humor, using wit, as tough questions as any newsman, probably tougher.
Well, the other day, I think it was Zell Miller was on Jon Stewart, and, you know, Jon Stewart was asking him some tough questions, you know, and basically making him leave his talking points he's used to saying when he goes on any kind of softer type show. And, you know, he was very flustered by that because, you know, normally when you go on a show like that, you're just there and you get your points out and they let you do it. But Mr. Timberg is certainly right in that Bill Maher, Jon Stewart, too, you know, these are guys who will not let you just say what you want. But again, they don't have the ratings of Letterman or Jay Leno, on the other hand, either.
Is it because with humor you're always looking for that? You're not trying to throw a pitch that they're going to get everywhere else. You're trying to throw them a curve anyway. I mean, humor is like that. It's coming in at an angle. And so, therefore, the questions are just... If they're so inclined to use it that way,
I would argue that's why Bill Maher and Jon Stewart are funnier than those other guys as well, because of exactly that point you make. And the truth is that Letterman and Leno, whatever their political views are, for the most part, you know, given the size of their ratings and the corporate dollars at stake, they are too afraid to alienate their audiences by being at all really partisan or ideological, that in a way Bill Maher and Dennis Miller, Jon Stewart, with more niche audiences can afford to do.
Mm-hmm. I'd second that. I talk about Letterman and Leno as being first tier in the numbers of people who watch, in their carefulness. The second tier hosts have something else going for them. They're newer shows. When Letterman started and I covered it, he was willing to do all kinds of experiments, not so much political stuff, but have the show turn 360 degrees as you were watching it, and people would phone in and say, wait, you know, what's wrong with my set? He was willing to do all kinds of stuff that as he institutionalized, as he as he found out what it was to remain in the center of those ratings, he simply won't do anymore. Those other shows are new, and they're willing to try things.
Mm-hmm. Well, Saturday Night Live for more than a quarter century has been taking on politics in bits and pieces in its programming. And I'd like to play one clip here that people are probably very familiar with since last week and the Republican National Convention in New York. Here we have California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger actually riffing from a Saturday Night Live sketch.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
Okay, so we've heard economic girly man a lot in the past week. But as it turns out, that was a case of political speech imitating skit, because Schwarzenegger had never used that phrase before a Saturday Night Live routine had done so imitating him, riffing on him. So this goes back some ways, doesn't it?
It's absolutely correct. The play back and forth between the stereotype, the dumb Bush, the wooden Gore, remember in 2000, and that's what they were going with for some sense with Kerry. Once it's out there, the candidate has to deal with it. And although Howard Dean is now out of the race, I think he provides a very interesting example of how the stereotype leads the story.
Of his scream. His yelling into the
scream,
microphone.
The scream and all the comedy that followed was already based in a storyline. And the storyline was Howard Dean was the out-of-control guy, the guy who shot from the lip. Right. I saw in that Saturday Night Live skit, I don't know, Steve, if you saw it or others in the audience, where Dean is phoning his Democratic Party regulars.
And you know what? We're going to have to go for the punchline after break here. We're talking with Bernard Timberg and Steve Green, and we will return to our conversation. Also later, Polecat Creek in the show. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. Studies are showing that an increasing number of people, especially young adults, get their political news about the campaigns, from late-night TV comedy shows. According to a poll by the Pew Research Center, 1 in 5 people between the ages of 18 and 29 follow politics with shows like The Daily Show and Saturday Night Live. And politicians seem to be catching on to this. Arnold Schwarzenegger and John Edwards both announced their candidacies for governor and president on late-night TV shows. And some see signs of politicians' new comedic savvy on the stump and in convention speeches. We're talking today about TV comedy and politics. With us are Bernard Timberg, author of the book Television Talk. He's with us from Charlotte. And Steve Green, a professor of political science at NC State, is on the phone as well. Before the break, Bernard Timberg, you were talking about a routine that was riffing on Howard Dean.
On Howard Dean, yeah. He picks up the phone and he talks to one of his operatives. And he says, "Now, this is Howard Dean. Are you going to support me in the election or not?" And the guy on the other side says something. He says, "Okay, well, then screw you." And he hangs up. "This is Howard Dean. I'm going for election. Are you with me on this?" "All right. Well, you can just take yourself into a trash can." Hangs up. And he finally gets some people who are supporting him. He says, fine. And that kind of bluntness was caricatured in the press. And the candidates have to learn to use those stereotypes, transcend them, work with them. If they ignore them the way Dean did, it doesn't work. And the other thing that was, I think, really telling about the Dean campaign in the "I Have a Scream" speech was that it was created by a media effect. And I only found this out later through a Diane Sawyer report. That scream, which made him look so crazy, and I thought he looked kind of crazy, and it was kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
Was
the night of the Iowa
filter mic.
Yes, yes.
A filter mic was being used, as Diane Sawyer pointed out. Several days later, in a very careful report, she showed how it worked with the Good Morning America show, where people could be yelling, and all you can hear is the one voice mm-hmm. through the filter mic.
Because he was speaking to a room of 1,000 people who were otherwise yelling, so he was raising his voice, but the microphone was not picking up everybody else in the room. Yeah,
exactly, right. Exactly. So it was a collective scream. It wasn't crazy at all. Now, Sawyer got apologies from some of the news executives, belated and late, but the damage was done. And then you live by the Internet and die by the Internet. Mm-hmm. It was picked up in all those mixes, and it became this huge parody of a guy who was out of control rather than a guy who was screaming as part of a giant collective roar.
Yeah, no, Steve Green, what impact does all of this have? And Bernard Timberg just touched on the internet being used, and that's a huge tool right now, too,
right.
That didn't exist maybe 4-8 years ago in the last election cycles as much as it does today.
Right.
What impact does it have on voters, on that all-important group we call the swing voters?
You know, I think for the most part, it's just a megaphone. You know, it just amplifies these things. It's, you know, with Howard Dean's little scream thing and remixes being all over the internet, this isn't something, you know, it's not like that you weren't seeing, you know, a more sedate version on CNN and Fox and MSNBC. You know, it's taking the same basic, you know, what I call conventional wisdom and just, you know, making it more widely available. You know, the other thing, and I do think, you know, the internet is in many ways revolutionizing politics, but what studies like this recent Pew one tend to kind of overlook is say, oh, look at all these people getting their news from the internet now. Well, where on the internet are they getting their news? Most of them are getting it from CNN.com, NewYorkTimes.com, MSNBC.com, FoxNews.com. So you're still getting these exact, you know, same mainstream news coverage and those, you know, mainstream news values and stereotypes of candidates. And
but there are still people, are there not, who are not going to those established mainstream news venues, but are going to blogs, which should be opinion and linking. Ad infinitum. Well, I want to just quickly talk about state politics. There are really not any programs that do this at the state level that take jabs at, you know, the gubernatorial candidates, Burr, Bowles in the Senate race, or Mike Easley, Patrick Ballantyne at the gubernatorial level. Well, first of all, why not, Steve Green?
Well, I think you need to have, first of all, when you look at the jokes that are being made of national political figures, I mean, this is the stuff that, you know, we make fun of Bush and Kerry, you know, and Al Gore and Bill Clinton, and just, you know, the most prominent, Dick Cheney, the most prominent, most well-known political figures. You know, for the most part, unless he was in big news, you could not even make a joke about Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, because people just don't know who this is. Mm. And, you know, the sad truth is when it comes to state politics, most people, you know, probably can't name their governor. Or, you know, they're certainly not their state legislator in you know, NC State House. So, you know, to be able for it to be funny, people have to know, have that basic, you know, political knowledge to know where it's coming from. And when you look at voter knowledge of state and local politics, it's unfortunately kind of pathetic.
Right. Finally, how about John Edwards? How do you think he's going to come off ultimately as a figure that may be pilloried or made fun of? Any thoughts on that, Bernard Timberg? Because he is probably the most high-profile North Carolina politician
Dick
right
Cheney
now.
Dick Cheney has already appropriated him in the joke that he led with at the Republican convention, which came out of successful uses, test marketing in other venues. He makes this joke about himself. Well, they say John Edwards has the hair, and the charisma, and so do I. And everyone looks at him and laughs, or I did 30 years ago. Well. That image could work for him or against him. I guess my question to Steve would be, what effect will this be having, this comedy, on the 18 to 24 votes who may come out this election? They're more of the people who usually don't vote than that narrow 5% of the undecided swing votes that everyone's talking about.
You know, I just don't think it's gonna change too many votes. You know, there's. I know The Daily Show is certainly very popular among my students, and, you know, that may actually swing a few people in the leftward direction. But, you know, what the comedy tends to do as much as anything is honestly breed cynicism about politics. They cover negative things because usually that's what's funny. You know, somebody doing something great is not funny. And in that way, you know, I don't think it's the type of thing that's actually going to help get young voters to the polls. I mean, other things may, but I don't think that's one of the factors that will.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us today. Thanks very much.
I just
want to
add one quick thing. We could have a whole show on Michael Moore, who we didn't mention, the Michael Moore factor.
We may have to. Thanks for being with us. Steve Green is a professor of political science at NC State in Raleigh. Bernard Timberg is an independent researcher based in Charlotte. He is author of the book Television Talk. Now, tomorrow, September 11th, is the third anniversary of the attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. Poet Susan Davis considers the nature of anniversaries and how we make and preserve memories in her poem, September 11th, One Year After.
The truth is, I cleaned out my closets. I had the radio on, well, two radios, actually, one in the kitchen and one in the bedroom. the names ringing out in stereo as I discarded broken-limbed umbrellas, sad single mittens, receipts loosed from upended purses. There was surprising solace in the methodical turning of hanger heads, folding of woolen sweaters, in anticipation of true winter. I discovered an old friend's band jacket rumpled in the back, Mandy mowed into the tall grass of the Cyrillic varsity-sized bee. What was it for, Boylestown, Bishop? I found my daughter's snow boots, the ones she wore only once on my birthday, when we took the typical photographs, the three of us laughing and pointing into the propped-up camera, our snowman, with an actual carrot nose, standing stout in front. But the film was loaded wrong, and the pictures never took. I cradled those shiny red boots in my lotus lap as I lined the others, the worn-in, scuffed-up, loved shoes, in careful rows of two, all headed west towards an invisible arc. Oh, rescue! At 8:48, I was finished with the front hall and headed for my husband's closet, still clutching Bella's boots. A bell chimed. Two bells chimed. I stopped in the hallway, and there it was, the memory of last year before I knew. My baby daughter, whose name is the word for beautiful as well as the word for war, standing at the picture window, preparing to wave goodbye. My leaving was always easy, but that day, for the first time, she clung to me, her cries of no, 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 ringing around the room, and I thought, what's wrong? Downtown, in Washington, D.C., her father climbed the marble stairs to his government office, and the sky filled with planes.
State of Things senior producer and poet Susan Davis reading her poem, September 11th, 1 year after. Polecat Creek, the body of water, runs through the southwestern part of Guilford County. It is small. You might miss it if you were passing by. But another Polecat Creek is getting more notice, and rightly so, thanks to the elegant songwriting and lonesome harmonies of Laura Lynn Dossett and Carrie Sickenberger. Their new CD is Leaving Eden, and it features renowned banjo player and banjo maker Riley Baugus. Polecat Creek, the band, is playing in the Triad and the Triangle this weekend, and we're glad to have Laura Lynn, Carrie, and Riley with us here today. Welcome all.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for trekking in. Now, I'd like to start with how you, Laura Lynn, and Carrie got together. I understand that it was a few years back and you were in a book club together?
We were in a book club together, and I had been a singer earlier in my life and had just started playing guitar a bit. We had a club at Carrie's apartment, and I saw the guitar in the corner, and I said, you want to hear something I just learned? And we started singing a little bit, and some Carter Family songs, and realized how much we really liked singing together. I think we both noticed right away that the harmony was something that we obviously we liked hearing it, and it just seemed like a special thing.
What was the first song you sang together, Carrie?
The first song that Laurelyn sang was Gillian Welch's song Orphan Girl, and she just sang it to me, and then I fell off the couch because I thought her voice was so beautiful, and I wasn't really a singer at that time. I just sang alone.
So you had never sung before? Ever?
Not in public.
Really?
No.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like to come out and you know, say, well, I might be a person who sings in public now?
I was very reluctant. In fact, as Laurelyn likes to tell, I didn't show up for our first gig at a coffee shop around the corner. But
yeah. I also like to say that I discovered her because she's got an exceptional voice, and people who know her voice even outside of Polecat Creek know what a great singer she is. So I'll take credit for that.
Well, you've been getting lots of rave reviews because of those harmonies that you do, as well as, I should not leave Riley out of this, the instrumentation along there, but that the harmonies are just so spot on. Did you know similar songs going into this? Or did you have a background of knowing certain songs?
Similar but different, yeah.
we realized right away that we liked singing together, so we just started picking some kind of old Carter Family things and learning songs from other bands that we both liked, and it evolved. We weren't really even writing at the time. Mm-hmm. You had written a little bit, but mm-hmm. I had not written a whole lot, and that came later.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And certainly that's what your CDs are full of songs that are original, but they're in that old-timey way.
Yeah, I think part of it is that we write out of a more traditional sensibility. And the next thing that happens then is that the music that we put to it, you know, gives it a more traditional sound or an old-timey sound, would you say?
Yeah, and we had a band for a while without Riley. We were called Polecat Creek, but it was before Riley joined us. And our songs were missing something, and we were trying to get that old-time feel and writing in that vein, but there was something missing. And when Riley joined the band, it felt like a complete picture. Mm-hmm. That piece had been missing. And so I really do think that's so much of what makes our song sound old time, because Riley brings that tradition to it.
What do you think it was, Riley?
I just happened to be there playing the banjo. Yeah. The banjo is sort of an old time sounding thing, you know.
It can't help but do that, right?
That's sort of its job. Mm-hmm. You know,
I'd love to play a song right now from your new CD. This is the title track. It's called Leaving Eden, and this is about the Pillowtex closing that was all in the news just a year and a half ago.
Around this time last year, I can remember hearing it on the radio that they had closed the Pillowtex plant. And my first thought was, oh, no, not again. And what are those people going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, because that was one of many
plants. It was the biggest shutting in one day in North Carolina. 4,000 jobs.
It was huge, and it was on top of other things that had already happened. Mm-hmm. And so I just started thinking about you know, what I would do if I were in that situation. You know, would I be a leaver or a stayer? And I was thinking about what people lose when they choose to leave, to make a new life somewhere else, what they leave behind. And, you know, of course, it's so fortunate for me that the town is called Eden, because that made it such an easy thing
and
to write about.
And this is in Rockingham County. It was one of the plants that lost about 400
right,
jobs.
Right. And, you know, Eden, of course, was known for being the land of plenty and, you know, paradise. And it's not paradise when you're losing your job, you know? So it was...
Well, let's hear the song from Polecat Creek, Leaving Eden.
Hush now, don't you wake up. We'll be leaving at first light. Mama's buying you a mockingbird to lull you through the night. Across the dam by morning, here's a blanket for you to share. They're building down in Georgia.
Leaving Eden from the triad-based group Polecat Creek. We have a couple members from the group here right now. Laurelyn is with us, and Carrie is here, and Riley Bogus, who plays the banjo there. And Riley, Laurelyn, you wrote the song.
I did write the song.
And I understand that when you wrote it, it came to you, and then you called Riley, who was...
He was in England at the time, and I played it for him on the telephone because I wanted him to kind of get it in his head, because I had big plans for him to play the banjo on it when he got home.
And so what was your reaction when you first heard it?
Oh, my God. It was one of the most beautiful things I ever heard. I immediately heard banjo on it. There was no other instrument in my mind that worked for it.
So, because Laura Lynn, we should explain, was just singing the song.
Right.
Over
she
the
was
phone.
She was singing it, and it made me cry. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous song, and I was several thousand miles away in England and was ready to come and work on it right then.
So did you sit down with your banjo in England? And
no, I just sort of heard this little thing that was. Just sort of had that kind of idea. I mean, it's rare that I actually hear musical accompaniment to songs. You know, when I hear them the first time, you have to sort of work it out. But this is something that I heard
right
immediately. It was just meant to be that.
Right.
And I liked so much that it captured both kind of the moving feeling. I mean, traveling kind of moving feeling and the melancholy at the same time. So it has kind of a happy and sad thing going on at the same time.
Yeah.
The way
it plays.
Because
it.
I sort of hear people packing up the car, just rolling down the highway, and there are some songs that just give
the
sense of
songs.
Being on the road.
Yeah,
right.
Being on the road. Now, Riley Bogus, is this the banjo you have here? Is this one of the ones you've made?
This is actually one that I made. This is number 6 of the ones that I've built. It's the one that I've played. It was actually. It was stolen from my car in February and returned in June.
No, this was at the Grammys. It was stolen when you were at the Grammy Awards.
No, I wasn't at the Grammys. I was watching the Oscars on TV, and it was taken from my car in Winston-Salem. It's a much less.
How come
I guess
on.
I can't believe everything I read, because I read an account that said you were at the Grammys.
Well, you know how I mean. Things start out one way and then they escalate. It's that. Hey, you know that's a blue skirt, you know, and then you know by the time it gets back to me, it's a new shirt.
You're right. Well, we're happy. The bottom line that you got your banjo back.
Yes,
regardless
yes,
of
absolutely.
Where it was taken
right.
and what you were doing. At the time, we are talking today with Polecat Creek. They are Laura Lynn Dossett, Carrie Sickenberger, and Riley Bogus. We'll continue our conversation and take your calls just ahead on the state of things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava.
You didn't make those things that you said. Starts like a kiss and then burns me instead. Man of two minds is a beast of two.
That's Polecat Creek, and the band is with us here in the studio. Polecat Creek is Laura Lynn Dossett, Carrie Sickenberger, and Riley Bogus is playing with the group as well. Laura Lynn and Carrie, you're the chief songwriters for the group, and that was one of your songs, too. There's a line in there that I love, a man with two minds is a beast with two heads.
You know, we debated about that line a little bit. It's just that idea of, you know, a person having another side to them that doesn't always reveal itself until you're a little farther into the relationship. So,
it could be a woman of two minds.
It could, yeah. Mm.
Okay. You. So, your band is about 7-8 years old now, is that right?
The two of us have been singing together that long. It kind of goes through different incarnations, but yeah. We've been singing
and so, you hadn't done songwriting before that. So, you got started relatively, you weren't young in college or something when you started doing songwriting.
And we're still not young. I'm not really sure how that happened that we started. We just started wanting to add some original things to our shows. We were basically a cover band. And
what kind of covers did you do?
We did a lot of Gillian Welch, to be honest.
Carter Family.
Lots of Carter Family, Lucinda Williams, and Bonnie Raitt.
Yeah.
Those were our big ones.
Early on,
Now, somebody who knows a whole lot more about music than I do, I was commenting on how your harmonies just sounded so exact and luscious. But this person pointed out they were like Carter Family harmonies, and that was you'd reach a note together, and then one of you would sort of go off. Can you give us an example of how you do that? Is there a song that there might be where you do that kind of harmony?
Yeah, we could try a little.
Well, there's a song that Laura Lynn wrote that's on our new CD that's called That I Should Know Your Face. And I sing the lead on it, and Laura Lynn sings a high harmony. And if you listen, you can hear her staying on a note from time to time, and I'll move down. That might be an example of the kind of harmonies that we do.
That I should know your face, my love, like sorrow knows the morning dove. That I should hold you to my breast, come back to me is my request.
That was beautiful.
Thanks.
I'm getting cold in here. Laurelyn Dossett and Carrie Sickenberger from the band Polecat Creek. Riley, you add something to this band in the instrumentation you bring, and you've brought in your banjo. You're a banjo maker, too.
I am a banjo maker, yeah.
Yeah.
It's something that I really don't have a lot of time to do right now, but it's something I still enjoy. I made the banjos that they used in the film Cold Mountain, mm-hmm. which were sort of circa 1850s style.
Was that different from the kind of banjos you're making today?
Yes, this banjo, even though it looks very old time, is a sort of a modern version of the instrument. It includes frets, which are the bars that go across the fingerboard to stop the string in the right place to make the notes. Originally, banjos were fretless, and the ones that we made for the film set in the 1860s were fretless in nature and homemade looking, sort of.
So you had to make three of them.
I did.
Why? There weren't three banjos in the movie, were there?
No. There were three of them because when one of the actors would break a string, the prop master wanted to be able to immediately grab another one exactly like the last one, put it in the actor's hands, and continue shooting, because apparently it's very expensive to be on site and on location.
And they didn't have a lot of those style banjos.
No.
This was shot in, what was it, Romania?
In Romania. They couldn't run out to, you know, they couldn't send the train to Bucharest and pick up another 1850 style banjo for some reason. I hadn't figured that out yet. But, so that's what they did. They ordered three of them. And then there's a scene in the film where it ends up broken. And it's sort of left your imagination how it ends up broken in the scene. But you see banjo pieces lying all over the ground there.
Wow. Yeah. So you also had a role. It wasn't just making the banjos, but you played. You're on the CD
right.
A couple of times there on the soundtrack that came from the movie Cold Mountain, which is set in the mountains of North Carolina, even if it was filmed in Romania. But your job was also to make sure, after you had recorded the music, to make sure that the actors who were playing on that very banjo were playing the right strings.
Well,
or not making real gaffes that a musician would see.
Right. Yeah, we came back to the studio and had to review the footage of the songs and the actors working together, the music and the scenes themselves, and if there was a stroke that was different, we had to fix it in the music after it was shot. So I mean, it was literally 4 or 5 weeks before the film was to hit the cinemas that we were doing these edits and loops.
So you're changing the music to match what
the
actor was, even if it was not the note you really wanted to be hitting?
Well, we would just change, we would make it sound like the actor was doing whatever was there. so if there was a bow stroke in a place where there wasn't a note, we would add a note.
Okay.
Or we would take out a note if there was a bow stroke, if there was no bow stroke, where there was a note. Yeah, or a hand stroke or what have you.
This is a fine art of banjo syncing.
Yes, banjo sync. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And so you worked with the director, Anthony Minghella?
I did work with Anthony Minghella. He was a great deal of fun to work with.
Yeah, how so?
He's a very sensitive man, first of all. I mean, he does very sensitive films, and he wants you to be comfortable when you're working in the studio with him, and we were, I actually sang on the soundtrack as well, and we did this one song which does appear sort of in the film, but it's called The Cuckoo, and he never just called it The Cuckoo. He would always call it The Cuckoo Bird, and he'd come in the morning, he'd try to make you feel very comfortable about who you were and what you were doing, and want you to feel like you're in the right place, and he'd say nice things to you like, "Oh, Riley, your face always looks as if you've just been for a wash. You know, you're perfect. Thank you so much. Dear friend, thank you so much for being part of our project. And you know, I started warming up to him right away because it made you feel awful comfortable, you know. And he came in there one morning where we're going to do this cuckoo bird, and he says, O'Reilly, on the cuckoo bird, when you're singing, oh, the cuckoo bird, she's a pretty bird and she warbles as she flies. When you get to that bit right there, could you just include, perhaps you could just say, coo, coo. Well, that song being from North Carolina and me being from North Carolina and everything, I'm just trying to figure out how I was going to tell Anthony Minghella no. But ultimately, we did it, and it was a good thing. So when you hear that cuckoo on the soundtrack, that cuckoo is actually me. We did it a little different than the way Anthony wanted to do it. But he was a great guy. He was a great guy to work with. He was very understanding and open to musical ideas.
Well, thank you for that. We are talking with Riley Vaugus, Carrie Sickenberger, and Laurelyn Dossett, who are Polecat Creek, and we're talking about the music they make. Riley plays banjo, fiddle, guitar on the new CD, Leaving Eden, and Laurelyn and Carrie wrote the songs and sing the songs there. There's another track on here that this won an award at Merlefest in the gospel category.
I was as surprised as you sound right now, actually. This is a song, I don't know how to explain it. It's sort of a simple song, and not one that we have both submitted a lot of songs to that contest over the years, and I was very surprised to get that phone call that I was a finalist.
Mm-hmm. And this is Come By Here from Polecat Creek. That's Come By Here from the band Polecat Creek. They're based in the Triad, and they're here in the studio with us today. Laurelyn Dossett, Carrie Sickenberger, and Riley Vaugus. That won you $125 and a guitar.
It did.
At Merlefest.
It did. I've just been raking it in this year, yeah?
Yeah. That was this year's Merlefest.
That was this year's Merlefest.
Well, congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I read someplace tell me if this is correct, mm-hmm. That you wrote that in reaction to some people who are so certain about everything that they seem to get direct instructions and signs from God. That's great for them.
Yeah,
quote unquote.
It's great for them, and I'm not one of those people, I guess. So I was just trying to write a song for those of us who just have to muddle through without signs from God. Yeah.
Okay. But there are some rather gospel sounding, and we heard earlier in the Bottle Tree song. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just some rather mystical sound to that as well.
Well, a lot of things that come out of traditional music when you're writing in a traditional style just will come from ideas and kind of universal notions that spirituality or, you know, Bible stories or whatever, mm-hmm. will be part of that just because it's part of the tradition.
Yeah. Was this the kind of stuff you listened to growing up? What were you listening to when you were kids? Carrie Sickenberger?
My dad listened to Doc Watson a lot. So mm-hmm. I did grow up with a foundation in the old time tradition. And mm-hmm. That his voice is still one of the most comforting sounds to me. So that's what I used to listen to. I didn't appreciate it as much then as I do now, but mm-hmm. that's what I grew up with.
And you grew up here in North Carolina?
I did.
Okay, okay. And Laurelyn?
I was raised mostly in Pennsylvania. We moved around a lot, but my parents were Southern Baptists, and so I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church singing all those hymns and mm-hmm. singing all the harmony parts because I was bored.
Now, with harmony, would that have been welcomed? I just wonder if that...
Sure, and yeah. That, yeah, it wasn't a primitive situation. Yeah, it was just regular old... you know, the Baptist, Southern Baptist hymnal. It's blue cloth.
You remember it well.
I remember it.
And Riley, what were you listening to when you were growing up? Now, you grew up in the Piedmont, in the Triad area.
I did. I grew up in Walkertown, North Carolina, near Winston-Salem. And my family was from up in Allegheny County, so they were raising me as if we were still living in Allegheny County. I didn't know any difference, but we were listening to music that was – well, we listened to Doc Watson. I listened to people like Tommy Jarrell, who was a National Heritage Award-winning fiddler from Surry County in North Carolina. And we listened to country, certainly country music and all kinds – and Ralph Stanley. And we had a very varied a bunch of music that we listened to, you know, a bunch of different styles, but it was mostly all traditional folk music. We listened to Mississippi John Hurt blues stuff, you know, and we had an eclectic sort of collection of music to choose from.
And you started playing when you were what, 8, 10 years old or so?
I was 10 years old. The Winston-Salem Forsyth County School System decided that they were going to begin a strings program, and I wanted to learn to play the fiddle, and I thought that they were going to teach me to play the fiddle, and I soon found that Dvorak's Slavonic Dances was not what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And so I moved on from there, although I did stay in the program and I learned a lot of music theory and a lot of helpful things pertaining to music. But I started steeping myself in the old-time music and the traditional music in North Carolina and Southern Appalachia.
Right. We have a phone call here, actually, from Steve is calling. And, Steve, you're listening in Connecticut?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it must be on the internet, either that or our signal's going really far these days.
Well, Laura Lynn was nice enough to send me a link.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Laura Lynn. How are you?
I'm great.
Sounds great.
Well, good.
Steve and I
played together 20 years ago in a band at Penn State, and he's a very fine musician, and we've reconnected in the last few years. I didn't know where he'd gone, and so he's become a Polecat Creek fan, even though he's not really a country music kind of guy.
So what kind of music were you playing in your band, Steve?
Well, Laura Lynn is very versatile. We were doing a lot of Joni Mitchell and Ricky Lee Jones and Bonnie Raitt and James Taylor. She could just sing about anything.
Right.
But we weren't doing any harmonies, and the harmonies are just spectacular on your record.
Yeah. Well, great.
Thank you.
Well, Steve, thanks for your call.
Good to hear from
you. You're welcome. All right.
Okay. So y'all are going to be playing in the area this weekend. Do you play a lot? Do you get out and do a lot of dates?
Well, we have a CD to sell now, so we will be. we had one before, but yeah, it does go in spurts. Mm-hmm. And this summer was filled with lots of music camps that we all like to do. Laurel and I have done some harmony workshops, and I do harmony workshops with other people too. And so, but this weekend we're playing three different venues, mm-hmm. one in Winston-Salem tonight and tomorrow night in Greensboro and then Sunday in Durham. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will continue through the early fall anyway.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. The sound is just really wonderful.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's great to hear. Well, thank you for being with us today. And I was wondering, Riley, if you might take us out with some banjo playing for
sure.
a little bit? That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. And we could use your help on something. We're looking for a few good undecided voters, North Carolinians, who haven't made up their mind about the governor's race. If you're still choosing between Mike Easley and Patrick Ballantyne, drop us a line at sot@wunc.org. Thanks to Polecat Creek for being with us today. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.